This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Elaine Shalino, just got back from Iran, where she covered the elections for the New York Times. It was her first time in Iran since she was expelled from the country 10 years ago. Shalino had been the first American journalist allowed into Iran after the hostage crisis. She was made to feel welcome until the revolutionary leaders read her reports, which they said were filled with lies. Back in 1979, as a correspondent for Newsweek, she had this distinction of being the first woman and the first American to interview the Ayatollah Khomeini. In fact, she was with him on his plane when he flew back to Iran, ending his exile in France. Shalino has written for the New York Times since 1984. She's covered the Middle East, served as diplomatic correspondent, and now writes about intelligence issues as well as foreign affairs. I asked Shalino to compare what she saw on the streets of Tehran today with what she saw 10 years ago.
It's interesting. It looks remarkably the same. There has been very little new construction in Tehran in the last 10 years. And looking out the window from my hotel, which was the same hotel I stayed in 13 years ago, I could still see the children's theater that had started to be built back then and still is not completed. The city is cleaner now, interestingly enough, than it was 13 years ago. And much of the anti-American graffiti is off the walls. And you're starting to see some Western advertising, which had basically been banned at the time of when Ayatollah Khomeini was at his height. But what really struck me was how remarkably the same the city was. The same stores, the same merchants, the same, carpet dealers. The same people, the employees in the hotel, the same telex operators, the same cleaning women. It's quite extraordinary how, revolution changed so many things, but that so many things stayed the same.
You say the stores are the same, the merchants are the same, but in your articles you wrote that there's more American goods in the stores than before.
Yes, that is one change, that you're starting to see American culture seeping back into Iran. Ayatollah Khomeini's probably turning over in his grave because he ranted for years about what he called the Westoxication of the country. But you can go to any little kiosk on a street corner and get Marlboro cigarettes. You're starting to see just a small number of American cars, especially for those who are wealthy enough to go to a place like Dubai and bring one back. I think you'll start seeing more and more American goods as time goes on. On the other hand, there is a lingering suspicion of the United States sort of being like the great puppet master behind everything that happens in the region. There is genuine concern about the U.S. military presence in the Gulf, the continued U.S. military presence in the Gulf. There is extraordinary distrust of the United States and why, for example, is the United States so concerned about Iran's nuclear program, and why is the United States so concerned about a North Korean ship that may be bringing Scud missiles to Syria via Iran when, the United States is continuing to sell all sorts of arms to other countries in the Middle East.
One of the just interesting little things that happened while you were in Iran, you had the TV on, and after the evening news and the evening prayer, they played Frank Sinatra's recording of Strangers in the Night. That must have been a very odd sensation.
Well, it was odd because I had been there in the old days. I suppose it wouldn't have been that odd if you had never been there before. But, I had been there in the days when where everything that was considered Western or American was somehow deemed evil. And, women who wore Western clothes could be lashed or arrested. And people who threw parties where alcohol was served would be arrested. And this still happens, but to a much lesser extent. The revolution is focusing on other things these days. But to hear Frank Sinatra's voice singing a love song, Strangers in the Night, was just blew my mind because, this is a country where it's still illegal to have CD discs. And it's a country where American music is still banned, although there's an extraordinary lively black market on the streets. It's a country where American films are banned, but you can buy just about any American film underground on the streets as well. So, you know, to see this sort of part of the street culture brought to the TV was quite stunning. But I think somebody was just having a joke, frankly.
Oh, really? But you're allowed to do that and get away with it. That's significant.
Well, I think what's happening is people are testing the system, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And that's the way I looked at it, is that, you know, a producer had to fill 5 minutes of airtime at the end, and he said, what am I going to do? So he put on the screen this picture of this gorgeous villa with bathed in blue light with a swimming pool and palm trees, and then played Frank Sinatra. And I'm sure that many of the people in the audience thought this was just terrific.
The purpose of your visit to Iran was to cover the Iranian elections. What was at stake in this month's elections?
Well, what was at stake was that President Rafsanjani needed to get a majority of the votes in the parliament in order to push through his reforms. President Rafsanjani is a very interesting, complex character. He's a pragmatist. He's by no means a moderate. He's by no means, a man in a business suit hidden under his clerical robes. He is a state builder. Whether you look at this as good or bad depends on where you're sitting, I suppose. And he realizes that if this regime is going to survive, that it needs to push through very drastic economic reforms. He has not enjoyed a majority in the parliament or the Majlis. It's sort of like George Bush not having control of the Congress. And he knew that he needed to get control of the parliament or the Majlis this time if indeed he was going to be able to institute these reforms. So before the election, he was able to prevent a number of his hardline opponents from running. It was a brilliant political maneuvering to get an awful lot of troublesome people off the slate, those people who I call revolutionary purists, who are unwilling to compromise for what Rafsanjani believes are the pragmatic goals of the revolution. What happened, however, is that he got his slate won much bigger than anyone had expected, even with the so-called rigging of the slate. And even though there will have to be a runoff in the beginning of May, the trend was absolutely clear that those who voted were rejecting the purists who had not brought them the prosperity that they want.
Well, you know, it's hard to understand in a way what the issues actually are in the elections. Only the, quote, spiritually correct can run for office. Mm-hmm. And parties were banned in 1987.
Yes.
So, like, what exactly is the competition about?
I think people were voting their pocketbooks, frankly. The people in Iran who voted are sick and tired of slogans. And I think the most striking impression that I came away from was just how the average Iranian is suffering economically. It was stunning. Iran is a rich country. It's an oil-rich country. But in the last decade, there has been an extraordinary population boom. They suffered through 8 years of war, and the country has not been able to get economically back on its feet again. People can't afford to feed their children. I visited the home of a friend, a guy who I had known in Paris, 15 years ago, who had been a student opposed to the Shah back in the 70s. And he, after the revolution, became a diplomat. He worked in the foreign ministry. Now he's a vice minister in one of the ministries. And he is living like a poor man. He doesn't have central heating. He has a very, very small apartment. His wife and his children basically don't even live in the apartment because it's so poor. They live with her parents. He certainly has not improved his life because of the revolution. And this is the way it is with millions and millions of people. The revolution was made in the name of the Mustazafin, the oppressed, and the oppressed have not done better. And so what they were doing was saying, Rafsanjani is our last hope. We need change. We need foreign investment. We need foreign loans. And we're going to vote our pocketbooks.
So Rafsanjani is seen as the last hope because he stands to improve ties with the West and open up trade. Is that it?
Yes, that's about it. Now, whether that is going to be a trend that will last once Iran gets on its feet is another question. And I don't think anybody, any of us know the answer to that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Elaine Shalino. She writes for the New York Times and just returned from a trip to Iran where she was covering the Iranian elections. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Elaine Shalino. She covers intelligence and some foreign policy for the New York Times. And we're talking about her trip to Iran where she was covering the elections. You say that if Rafsanjani gets a majority in parliament, as it looks like he will after the runoffs, that this will be the first time that there's no outside boogeyman to blame for problems in Iran. No Shah, no war, no revolutionary government. What does that mean? I mean, what does that mean for Rafsanjani and for Iran?
Well, it means that Rafsanjani's political future is on the line and his reputation as a political leader. He's got to prove himself to his people now. He can't, as I wrote in one of my articles and as you said, he can't blame the country's economic problems on an outsider. There is no Iran-Iraq war that's hurting the economy. There is no great Satan that is troubling his country. If he fails, he only has himself to blame. He has a mandate now, and he has no excuses. And I think that he probably has another year or so to prove to his people that he can pull things together and bring them some kind of relief. I mean, from everywhere I went in Iran, people complained that they didn't have enough money to feed their kids.
Well, you know, it's interesting that in countries around the world, it's economic issues that are really the major issues in the elections, and that's certainly even true in the United States.
That's absolutely true. You know, the average Iranian in the street did not want to talk to me about exporting the revolution to the Sudan or,
right.
You know, how are we going to make our revolution popular in the Central Asian republics? It was, how am I going to feed my kids? You know, what can I do to earn enough money? And there just was this sense of people being really worn down by daily life.
Yeah, you know, saying that, I'm wondering if Salman Rushdie is an issue to anybody in Iran. I mean, he's still living in hiding. The fatwa is still in effect. Does anyone in Iran seem to really care? Do you think that could reasonably be lifted now without causing too much of a fuss in Iran?
No, it can never be lifted. Most people couldn't care less about Salman Rushdie, but the fact is Ayatollah Khomeini issued a religious ruling, which is called a fatwa, and that cannot be lifted. It's one of the tragedies of that revolution, and it's one of the impediments to making that country look as if it's a responsible country with a responsible political leadership. At one point, Ayatollah Khomeini's successor, this was Ayatollah Khamenei, who was the new spiritual leader, sort of suggested that if Rushdie apologized, then this could be lifted or set aside, something like that. And the Ayatollah, was roundly criticized by the revolutionary purists, the so-called hardliners, and also by the strict conservative Islamic leaders in the country, because he wasn't living up to the letter of this ruling by Ayatollah Khomeini. I think that the current leadership, someone like President Rafsanjani, would just like people to forget about Salman Rushdie. And so, you know, every time Salman Rushdie pops up in London or in Washington or New York, it's a dramatic reminder that this is not a benign regime, that indeed this is a regime with all sorts of pressures and currents and cross currents, but it's by no means sort of on the verge of becoming westernized.
Was freedom of speech, human rights, issues for the Iranian people?
It depends on where you sit. You know, if you have an uncle in prison, then human rights is a major issue for you. If you are an ordinary Iranian with nothing to do with politics, you don't care. It's interesting that the press in Iran is extraordinarily lively and extraordinarily free. Well, up to a point, much freer than most of the Middle Eastern presses. The different newspapers brutally criticize the government, and just about the only thing that can get you into real trouble is if you insult the Prophet Muhammad or if you insult Ayatollah Khomeini. And while I was there, a magazine got shut down because it had run a picture that looked as if it was a caricature of Ayatollah Khomeini, and there were demonstrations outside the office and damage done to the office. But I found that there was much more openness in terms of people being less afraid to talk now than 10 years ago. It's certainly a country where people feel more free to talk than against the government than they would in a country like Saudi Arabia, and certainly a country like Iraq. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you know, Iran, again, is not a benign regime. It's a regime that has been involved in various ways in various acts of terrorism. It is a regime where the prisons are filled with political prisoners and where you can get executed because of your political beliefs. So it would be wrong to characterize this as a country that's about ready to embrace you know, Western ideals of democracy and respect for human rights.
Do you think that relations might be restored between the United States and Iran in the near future?
No, I don't. I think that you'll start to see an increase in trade ties. There is a realization that in some areas they need American technology. For example, the drilling equipment for the oil fields and a lot of the other oil-related technology can only come from the United States. On the other hand, the United States has a virtually total trade embargo against Iran, and there may be little by little a lifting of the trade embargo so that Iranian goods can start to come back into the United States, but it's going to be very, very slow.
You've pointed out that the Iran-Contra scandal has been perhaps as embarrassing for the Iranians as for the Americans. What's embarrassing in Iran?
Well, it's not embarrassing anymore, but it certainly was at the time. And I think in one of my articles, I used it to show how after it was revealed that Iran had been buying weapons from the United States, Rafsanjani had to do some very fancy footwork to explain to his people why Iran, which had based its revolution on independence from the United States and independence from outside powers, needed American technology. And he did it very well by basically portraying the American mediators and the American officials who came to Iran as buffoons. And he has survived that firestorm, although other leaders might not have done so well.
Do you think that being a woman was an advantage or disadvantage in any way in getting the story this time around?
Oh, I've always thought that being a woman working in the Middle East gives you advantages. It's very odd. I think that in all of the Middle East, there is this sense of hospitality. They don't want to say no to a woman. And, you know, if you play by their rules and if you put on a headscarf and if you, you know, wear this long coat, then you are saying, okay, I am playing the game by your rules. And I am not trying to be an American imperialist imposing my culture on you. And it was interesting. There were a lot of American journalists there who were women. The Washington Post correspondent, the LA Times correspondent, the New Yorker correspondent, and a correspondent who was writing a piece for the New York Times Sunday Magazine, and myself, we were all women. So there probably were as many women reporters as male reporters this time.
Do you think the Iranians consider that odd?
No, I don't, because you know, women in Iran, you know, unlike women in Saudi Arabia, do hold jobs. They can drive cars. They can walk down the streets by themselves. They do not hold high-ranking jobs. But the fact is, you don't get stared at in the street the way you do in the streets of Riyadh if you're walking down the street alone as a woman. I think they've gotten used to it over the years too. You know, they've seen Oriana Fallaci and they've seen Diane Sawyer and they've seen other good Western journalists who happen to be women.
I guess they see a lot of women on CNN, too.
They see a lot of women on CNN, too. But wait, I should correct that. Not the average Iranian doesn't get CNN, Terry. Only the high-ranking ministers are allowed to see CNN. So this is, again, this is not
are
a
allowed
country.
To? You mean it's not a question of being able to afford a television? It's a question of what you're allowed to watch?
Oh, yes, of course. No, no, no. There are real limits. You cannot just sort of put up a satellite dish and get CNN. It's not permitted. That really would be over the, that would be a little bit too much of an American influence, at least now.
Well, one last question. You recently started writing about intelligence for the New York Times. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if it's a very different process getting a story about what the CIA is doing than it is, you know, covering the Middle East.
Oh, good grief. I think you should invite me back another time and we'll talk about intelligence in the United States. Oh, it's very different. I had covered the State Department before I started covering the intelligence community. And, you know, you don't sort of get a press pass and a telephone inside the CIA.
Right.
You're not allowed to walk around the cafeteria schmoozing with intelligence officers the way you can do with Foreign Service officers in the State Department and with, you know, nice colonels in the Pentagon. So it's a very, very different process. And unfortunately, the best way to do your job is either A, to sit on the phone all day from morning till night and call people at home at 11 o'clock at night, or B, meet the people in, you know, dark bars or for lunch or for dinner because no one wants to talk to you on the telephone. So it's a different process. Very different.
Well, I hope to talk to you about that sometime soon on the show.
Okay.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, this has been fun. Thank you.
My guest has been Elaine Shalino, and she covers intelligence and foreign affairs for the New York Times, and she just returned from a trip to Iran where she was covering the elections. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.